CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This first segment of our show, folks, is a post-dated interview, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Carla Dell'Imperio will be giving us an update on PMSF. So what's the latest with the foundation?
Well, in preparation for today, I went back and listened to the interview we did a few months ago, and at least in my world, I can speak at length to the progress we've made on a number of programs. It's been a pretty exciting time at the Phelan McDermid Syndrome Foundation. I talked briefly last time about our thoughts on a mental health support program for our families, and we were awarded a grant from Global Genes in the spring. And we were able to implement a pilot mental health program. It's a caregiver support group program. And we contracted with a psychologist, Al Friedman, who's very well known in the world of rare disease, and a social worker, Kylie Richards. And the two of them have been facilitating support groups for our caregivers in our community throughout the world. They're virtual groups, so people can join from anywhere. And we've had great success with this program. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. And if you have any follow-up questions or interrupt me, of course. We decided to target three different categories for this program. So we have a general caregiver support group, which is offered for anybody in our community who's a member of our foundation who is a primary caregiver of a person with Phelan McDermid Syndrome. So for that program, we started with 7 meetings a month because there was so much interest, and we've kind of tapered down to 3 meetings a month with 25 slots to sign up for those meetings. So it's had a pretty broad impact. The second group was for caregivers of individuals with Phelan McDermid Syndrome whose adult child in many cases has gone through a period of neuropsychiatric illness, which is a kind of growing issue in our community. As our population ages, we're seeing this new neuropsychiatric illness emerging, usually in late teenage to early adult years, and it can be very, very hard for the caregivers to see the changes in their child, to be the ones caring for someone who's going through episodes of, you know, mania, catatonia. It can be very, very hard, and often that group feels very alone because nobody really understands unless they've gone through it. So we've given them a space to talk about it and process some of the feelings and difficulties. And that's been, we've offered 2 sections of that per month since the summer. And then the third group has been for our caregivers who have had their child pass away, which unfortunately we have had losses in our community. Even very recently, we lost a young adult with Phelan McDermid Syndrome. So we've been able to provide a space for those families who've lost a child to come together and talk in a supported setting with the mental health professional. And that has had one section a month since the summer as well. So the scope of this program has reached approximately 5% of our population. Our membership has been able to engage in these mental health support groups. So we've had, let me look at the numbers here.
So I'm curious, meanwhile.
Yeah, so we've had 150 total individuals participate in the support groups. The biggest group being our general group had 101 participants. The neuropsychiatric support group has had 35 participants, and our support group for caregivers who've lost a child has had 14 participants. So this has really been well received. We're working right now on rolling out some feedback surveys and kind of adjusting the program as we plan for 2024, but it's been a really groundbreaking program for our community, and I've been so pleased to see how it's come together.
So how are you reaching out to the families and patients affected who might benefit from these support groups?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
How are you reaching out to those who could potentially benefit from the support groups?
Yeah, so we've put it in our monthly newsletter, which always links to a blog post on our website, and then the blog post can easily be updated with the new Zoom registration links and information as, you know, things change a little bit, so we can edit and change the blog. So that's gone out to our membership every month that we've offered it. We've had the registration go out in our monthly newsletter. We've shared it on social media. I actually intend to share the November registration dates on our Facebook page and Instagram today. And if folks want to follow us on Facebook, our page is Phelan McDermid Syndrome Foundation, and that's where I'm posting about the groups. And then we also do a targeted email to people who've either expressed interest and have not yet been able to attend, or people who've already attended the groups. And then we do have some other groups on Facebook that are private groups where we can share the public posts in those groups to kind of continue to raise awareness. So after each different push, I've seen a spike in registration. So I know that different people are finding out about it through different ways. And it seems to be that our population has heard about it. People are interested, and we have no trouble getting folks to sign up, which has been great.
So what are some of the key benefits your membership's enjoying by being a part of a community and being able to share their stories and their insights and not having to face the mental health concerns all on their own?
Well, I think when you're a family dealing with a rare disease diagnosis, you can feel so alone. I mean, even we do have 3,500 worldwide. I'm sorry, 3,200. I'm not sure why I said 3,500. But that is still such a small amount to connect with others. Often there are not opportunities to connect in person. It can be hard to meet others in person that have the same diagnosis in there for their child. So to offer these virtual conversations can be a really great way to help people not feel isolated and not feel alone. And then maybe the next time there is an in-person offering, which, you know, we do have in-person get-togethers in different states throughout the year, maybe the person would then be more likely to go because they've already had some kind of a connection and taken that step in a virtual setting, which I think can be a little bit safer and a little bit easier to access.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward and not just dealing with the condition itself, but providing supports for those who do deal with it on a day-to-day basis, what would you say?
Well, I think before I even say the message, you've really hit the nail on the head with what our mission is at our foundation, which is, you know, supporting families now with the challenges they face, but also looking at the long term for treatments and cures at the science and research piece of how are we going to make this better in the future. For families, I would tell them to, you know, roll their sleeves up and take a chance and come to a session, start engaging in our programs, try to meet other people, because the community we have is really incredible. We have so many supportive families. We have wonderful scientists and researchers and doctors who know about Phelan-McDermid syndrome, have an interest in it, and work on it to move things forward. So the more people can just get involved with our foundation. I mean, all the programs we offer, our membership, everything is free. I encourage people to join and get involved and take a step to try some of our programming. We also have a brand new genetic counseling program that I think it's, yeah, it started after we last spoke. So that was in May. And we have contracted with a genetic counselor at Mount Sinai in New York, and she sees one family a week for free genetic counseling. So it's at no cost to the families. So since that program started, we've had over 20 families meet with the genetic counselor and receive this free service, which for many families, they first of all, don't get quick, prompt genetic counseling. They have long waits, even up to 2 years. People have waited for genetic counseling. And then when they do finally speak with a genetic counselor, it's someone who maybe doesn't know a lot about Phelan-McDermid syndrome or maybe has never heard of it before. So this is a way to give that to families quickly, at no cost, and help them get answers of next steps for testing and whatnot. So that it's another example of a new program since you and I last spoke.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
It's my pleasure.
In this segment of our show, Ted Trahan will be telling us a little bit about the OI Foundation.
So what can you tell me about the OI Foundation?
Yeah, well, the OI Foundation has the mission of improving the quality of life of people living with osteogenesis imperfecta, or OI. And we do that through research, education, awareness, and mutual support.
So how do you go about reaching out to those affected?
So there are several avenues through which we reach out, and the first is that we hold gatherings of people with OI, individuals and families. So we have a national conference that occurs every 2 years, and then every year we have a series of regional conferences to bring information and physicians and clinicians closer to where people are living. In addition to that, the foundation prints publications and press releases and is on social media such as Instagram and Facebook, and of course there's the website oif.org.
So for those who might not be as familiar, what are the typical effects of OI?
So the hallmark of osteogenesis imperfecta is brittle bones. But OI is primarily due to defects in the collagen molecule. And collagen is used in connective tissue throughout the body. So other body organs that use connective tissue could also be affected. So that might be, for example, your hearing, lungs, or teeth.
So, that being said, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
Well, there certainly can be, and the risk of misdiagnosis comes about from a couple of factors. One, with OI being a rare disease, there certainly are physicians out there who are not familiar with it, and therefore, you know, correct diagnosis may be delayed. But also there's the case where a child might come in with a broken arm, and upon evaluation, it might be discovered that there are other cracks in the bones, and so the possibility for accusations of child abuse are also a risk.
So, do you have any advice for those out there who might be starting a diagnosis journey, wondering if this might be what's impacting them?
Well, yes, and the OI Foundation is set up to connect families or individuals with a new diagnosis with physicians that can help correctly identify whether or not it actually is osteogenesis imperfecta, and also to provide information in terms of toolkits for families with new diagnoses that provide lots of information about care and management of a child with brittle bones.
So I'd imagine for a child with OI, things like being a part of school sports, for example, would be something that would be a lot more difficult.
School sports and really all activities are something that can be managed. There are different levels of or different degrees of OI. Some are more mild and some are more severe. So those with more mild types may be able to participate in sports. Others with more severe types will have to manage their participation. So, for example, many schools and school districts now have adaptive physical education, which allows people with disabilities to participate in sports in a modified format. And just as one example of that, we had a elementary school sort of sports day, and one of the sports that they included was a wheelchair race, which was very appropriate for the child in the class who had OI.
So, out of curiosity, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by OI?
The estimate, at least within the United States, is that OI occurs in about 1 in 20,000 to 50,000 people.
So, in your time with the OI Foundation, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Well, there certainly are several success stories. One is simply the fact that the OI Foundation is connecting with members of the OI community, connecting people with information that's been vetted by medical professionals, and actually connecting people with those professionals who are at the top of the field of OI. But physicians who are researching OI have established a standard of care, which at this time is the use of bisphosphonates to treat children with OI. Through organizing and advocacy, research continues. There's a consortium of academic research clinics around the country that are engaged in basic science research into the causes, effects, and treatment of OI. And also there is sort of a more recent evolution looking at or inviting patients to talk about what their outcomes are that they are looking for in a series called Patient-Centered Outcomes Reporting. And finally, I would say that the OI Foundation is collaborating with other rare disease organizations with the idea that advances in one area of rare disease can lift and make progress in all areas of rare disease.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes, thank you so much.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Blood donors are needed now as much as ever. If you would like to help meet the needs of patients across Canada, please consider booking an appointment by calling 1-800-2-DONATE. That is 1-800-236-6283, or by visiting blood.ca or through the Give Blood app. The Windsor Blood Donation Centre location is at 3909 Grand Maris Road East. Make a difference with the Canadian Blood Services.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Carla DeLimperio gave us an update on PMSF, and we heard a little bit about the OI Foundation from Ted Trahan.
In this segment of our show, Stephanie Condon-Aldreeve will be telling us a little bit about Craig's Cause. So what can you tell me about Craig's Cause?
So Craig's Cause Pancreatic Cancer Society was formed in 2006 informally after my dad, Craig, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and passed away from it. So we really started off as a grassroots organization. In 2007, we incorporated as a nonprofit organization, and then in 2011, we received our charitable status and have since grown from a grassroots organization to a national charity that's recognized across Canada. We work with cancer centers throughout Canada, and we have four pillars: public awareness, patient support, healthcare education, and research.
So, how do you reach out to the affected population to let them know that your supports exist?
There's a variety of ways. You know, we certainly, under our pillar of public education, we do a lot of awareness campaigns, not only about pancreatic cancer, signs and symptoms, risks, you know, diagnostic pathways, clinical trials. So, you know, we certainly get, you know, have great opportunities to be interviewed throughout Canada. So patients hear about us that way, and sort of healthcare, or, and then our healthcare group, we reach out through various educational opportunities for them, whether it's accredited sessions at continuing education programs, to e-learning modules, to a national pancreas conference that we hold. This is our second year for the National Pancreas Conference. We've had Eastern symposiums as well. So a lot of it's through social media, through the physicians knowing about our programs in the cancer centers. We work with collaborative work with cancer centers, working with other like-minded organizations.
So I'm curious, through the education work that you do, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning pancreatic cancer?
Oh, yeah. You know, certainly pancreatic cancer, you know, has certainly been labeled the death sentence of cancers. You know, we do have the highest mortality rate of all cancers. Even though we have a smaller population affected, we're the second leading, well, we'll be the second leading cause of all cancer deaths in 2030. Currently, we are in the third place, for a place that we don't want to be, for this, the third leading cause of all cancer deaths. So we surpassed breast cancer death probably in 2021, and we're certainly projected to, you know, become the second leading cause of all cancer deaths. So a lot of patients, you know, often hear upon their diagnosis, go home and get their affairs in order, treatment's not really effective, you know, clinical trials really aren't available. You know, do you want to spend your last month sick with chemotherapy? You know, it's a disease just for the older generation. So there's a lot of myths, but that's what they are. They're myths. You know, we do know through, you know, a lot of translational research that patients living with pancreatic cancer have a better quality of life, and they live, have a longer lifespan when they are involved in clinical trials. They are receiving the best practices, treatment and care and management of their disease. We have probably about 50% of our population, not probably, we have about 50% of our population who is diagnosed with metastatic pancreatic cancer don't receive any form of treatment, even though we know that they have a better quality of life and they live longer with treatment. 50% are not even offered treatment options. We know that over 81% of our patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer have pancreatic exocrine insufficiency, which is also seen in cystic fibrosis patients. In cystic fibrosis patients, patients who have PEI or pancreatic exocrine insufficiency, all of them receive pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. Only 20% of our population receives pancreatic enzyme replacement therapy. And only 50% of that 20% are actually receiving the accurate dosage. And PERT has actually the same, if not more, benefits to pancreatic cancer patients than chemotherapy themselves. It keeps them in treatment for longer periods of time. So those are just, you know, some of the myths that we're trying to educate the healthcare community and also the general public on that. You know, we do have a high mortality rate, but there's a lot of patients who receive best practices, treatment, and the management of their disease that have a good quality of life, and they're living for much longer periods of time than projected. So like getting in to see a specialist who treats pancreatic cancer patients is quite essential, understanding the disease itself.
So do you have any advice for someone who's just starting out their journey and is jumping to the worst case scenario? Do you have any thoughts as to how they can keep their head on what this is from a realistic standpoint and get some help?
I think, you know, if a patient is diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, I think first and foremost, they need to ensure that they have current best practices, treatment and management information. You know, that they don't hear, go home and get your affairs in order, that they do ask to see a specialist, a surgeon, and a medical oncologist who have experience treating pancreatic cancer patients, and also see a dietitian or nutritionist trained in pancreatic exocrine insufficiency. You know, second, that they need to know that there's a lot of support out there, you know, so it's really important to connect with the pancreatic cancer community. We have several support groups that patients come to religiously every week, you know, getting support from each other. We have support for caregivers. We have a nurse navigator, you know, and also it's really important to look into clinical trials. You know, another myth connected to pancreatic cancer, but connected to a lot of cancers, is that clinical trials are the last-ditch effort, and that's just not the case. Clinical trials really should be looked at upon diagnosis. So if you're diagnosed with pancreatic cancer or any cancer, you really need to make yourself aware of what clinical trials are available for you. Because more often than not, you have the standard of care plus. And that plus means that you're surrounded by a team of researchers and clinicians and nurses trained and interested in treating that specific disease and looking for better treatment and management practices. So you're really going to put yourself into some great hands of specialists who are connected to the research world. Many times you think of clinical trials as this last ditch effort, and it's only when you have a little bit of time left. But in fact, every time you get a different form of treatment, it excludes you from more and more clinical trials. So upon diagnosis, it's really important that you have a biopsy. You know, tissue is the issue. That was by Dr. Daniel Rayson has always said that. You need to make sure you have the correct diagnosis. So you have pancreatic cancer or breast cancer or lung cancer. But under that family name are various tumors within each of those diseases. So you really need to know and ensure you have the correct diagnosis of pancreatic cancer and that tumor type. Molecular profiling is important if that's available to you. And then looking at clinical trials, you know, and really time is of essence as well.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
Ted brings up one of the major potential pitfalls in disability life. If a child isn't properly diagnosed with a condition like OI, they can lead to brittle bones. If there's a suspicion of child abuse, that's a brand the parents would have to carry with them for quite a long time. Even if it's proven that that's not actually what happened, society's suspicions can be a dangerous thing. Fact is, they may be perfectly loving parents. They may do everything they can to support their child and their condition. The fact is, if a doctor doesn't necessarily recognize it, the problem lies with them, not with the parents working tirelessly to make sure their child has the best quality of life. This is where, if you don't get proper information, current information, it's just a risk factor, my friends. I admit that not every doctor can know every condition, but as a patient, it's your perfect right to seek understanding, to ask those questions, and to make sure that you're getting the best quality care and living the best quality of life that you can. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.